Brigadier Scott, Reel 1. Could you tell me, please, how you came to be in the army in the first place, which I think was 1939?
Yes, I was at that time working with the Liverpool Corporation Electric Supply Department and signed up in the Supplementary Reserve. Within a very short time, we found ourselves at the outbreak of war, actually in France. War was declared the same night. We went to the west of France as a unit and then moved up after a fortnight to the front line. We were in cattle trucks, 8 Hommes and 5 Chevals, and 40 Hommes or 5 Chevals, and we went into the area behind the Maginot Line, because we were all electrical engineers. And came the Christmas, and I was asked to go for an interview at Douai to see the district commander, as I was being recommended for a commission. And I saw him, and I said, "Please, sir, I want an infantry commission, not Royal Engineers." And he blew me out of the office. "I'd come back next week and see if you've changed your mind." And I went back the following week and said, "No, sir, I still would like to go to the infantry."
Why did you want to go to the infantry?
Well, I liked being with the men, personalities, rather than things, as it happened. And although I'd been an electrical engineer, I felt I would be happier in the infantry. And they sent me to Shawncliffe, which is the Royal Engineers depot, and they were collecting people for commissions there to go train as commissions. And there again they said that I really should stay as a Royal Engineer, and I said, "No, thank you, I want the infantry." As it happened, I was very lucky, because right next week I was sent to war, to the first war course at Sandhurst. And out of the blue, they'd said, "Right, you're going to Sandhurst, and you're going back to, you'll go to the infantry." And so I did the first war course as a cadet at Sandhurst. I was commissioned after the course finished, 4 months, and I was commissioned to my local regiment, King's Liverpool. And I joined them at Glasgow. We were made up of ex-First War officers, and several like myself, 4 or 5 like myself, who just joined the army. And I was sent on a course to Aldershot, and being rather fit, I was asked would I like to stay at Aldershot as a junior instructor, and I said no, I wanted to get back to my unit. And I went back to Glasgow, and after a while, matter of months, we were moved down to Felixstowe for coastal defence. We're a wartime battalion, of course, and I then spent the next 9 months on the coastal defence. We were then detailed for the Far East. We went to Oxford, Burford in Oxfordshire, and more recruits were brought into us, and we have to put up to full strength. And within 2 months, I was on my way to India. We went into central India, and we were then doing garrison duties at Secunderabad. We were earmarked for doing to relieve the Reggae Battalion, and what we did, we sort of took over their duties in central India. However, things hadn't gone too well, and it was decided that after a while, those of us who were young enough would form a unit, and we would be going to a new unit which was going off to the front. In the meantime, Ord Wingate had arrived in India, visited Burma, and Wavell, Field Marshal Wavell, had given him permission to form a unit to go on what they called long-range penetration. And those of us who were fit stayed in that training area with Wingate, and we became the 13th Battalion of the King's Regiment became the 1st British Battalion in the 88th formation. It was a Gurkha battalion and ourselves and engineers, etc. And we had some very honest training with General Wingett, and Brigadier Wingett as he was then. And after 6 months, we were told that we were going on the role which had been designed by Wingett to penetrate behind the Japanese, across the Chinwin, and penetrate behind the Japanese lines. This happened. We went down to Infal and then on to the Tone Hay on the Chinwin, and crossed in 2 nights, the Gurkhas and ourselves.
What do you remember about the crossing?
The crossing, a lot of the chaps couldn't swim, and all we had were three boats, and backwards and forwards we ferried. It took the whole of one night, plus a bit of the following day, to get us across. The Gurkhas had crossed a little lower down the river than we were. And so Wingett's first campaign started.
What, do you remember meeting Wingett for the first time? What kind of impression he made on you?
Oh, yes. I first met Wingett. This was the first time I'd seen Wingett actually getting ready for action. But and when we trained us, I'd met him in Tone Hay Forest in central India, and we were all very impressed with him.
In what way?
He inspired us with his aims. He used to give us what his aims were. He was completely dedicated to the end that we should all be fit and trained before we crossed the Chinwin. And a lot of the chaps did not get through the campaign of training. And I would say up to 25% had to be left behind. And we were made up of younger chaps. We crossed the Chinwin at Tone Hay, and perhaps someday I should let you have an order of the day he gave us. Would you like that?
Please.
A copy of the order of the day, which was an inspiring copy. This went to all ranks. Our first task was to form up. The Gurkhas were going to operate a number of miles to the south of us, downriver, and we were to penetrate across the Chinwin, once we got across the Chinwin, right towards the Irrawaddy. In the meantime, I'd been fortunate in that at the end of the training period, Wingett gave me command of one of his columns, number 8 column, and number 8 column then led off with Wingate's headquarters, and the rest of the column followed us. Our first threat had to be a town called Pinlaboo. We made our way down to Pinlaboo, and our total aim was this time was to disrupt the Japanese and their communications and act as a threat as opposed to capturing Pinlaboo. I was given the job of trailing my coat and to let the Japanese think that there was a main force coming behind. That time, Wingate had branched off to the east with the rest of the force. The Gurkhas were penetrating south of Pinlaboo. Although we never actually only had skirmishes with them, we never went into Pinlaboo. This is not a contradiction, but it said that we didn't, had a fight there, we did not. I skirted the town, had a bit of skirmishing, and then rejoined Wingett for a supply drop that night.
Can you describe what the skirmishing was like?
Yes, it was probing, really. We were probing and really trailing our coat, let us be seen, and then get out of the way, as it were. This was, to mystify the Japanese, to let them think we were going to attack Pinlaboo, of course, and we were not doing anything of the sort. We were going to move on.
What was the calibre of the Japanese you were up against at that time?
like most of the Japanese we met at that time, they were very, very good. They were made up of a regular battalion, part of a regular battalion, a regiment as it was, and partly wartime people. And by and large, what one saw of them, one was impressed with tactics. From Pinlabu, our then trip was across, go deeper into Burma. We headed for the railway, where Mike Calvert and Bernard Ferguson with a column each, Mike with a Gert column and Bernard Ferguson with another King's column, they were raiding some 15 miles south of us, and we crossed the railway without doing anything at all because we didn't want to reveal our position. Mike Calvert and Bernard Ferguson, of course, had to blow the railway up so the force knew, but they did not know that the 13th Kings had moved across the railway to the north and were heading towards the Irrawaddy. We had several minor things with the Japanese, patrols and that, but they didn't realise that the whole force was well dispersed. The fight with Mike Calvert and Bernard Ferguson going on to the south allowed us to penetrate even deeper than we would have done otherwise. We then came to the Irrawaddy, and I think most of us were shocked when we saw the rate of knots it was flowing and the width of it. However, we then started crossing. We crossed with boats and that. We were dropped on boats and that, and other chaps swam alongside us. We got all our men, all our mules across. I was crossed at the top, just below the Swale, just on the south bank of the Swale. So a place they were not expecting us. We then moved on south of that and down, penetrating in between the Swale River and the Irrawaddy.
What was the character of the countryside around there? Was it thick
jungle? Very thick. Very thick jungle. Very dry. We had to dig for water for ourselves and the mules. So the mules started failing. We had to move away from the Irrawaddy to get deep into the jungle there. And the aim was to go down, because we were going to head for Mong Mit to join the rest. Mike Calvert and Bernard Ferguson's columns were then some 15 miles south of me, and number 7 column. We were penetrating down there, and we started meeting the Jap resistance. We got to a place called Bor, which was strongly held by the Japanese.
Is that B-O-R?
What?
B-A-W,
Bor. I'll let you have all the things on this. B-A-W, and it was then that we had a signal. Wingate we had a supply drop. And Wingate was told that, in fact, if we had penetrated any further, we would be out of range of the aircraft and they could not supply us. So he made the decision there and then that we would split the brigades and we would all, by our own routing, return to India. And he advised us to drop right down into dispersal groups, with a young officer and his men with him, and column headquarters and a defence platoon with me. I felt that really, because we had to cross the Swale and hook round and recross the Irrawaddy, that I had to keep the chaps together. This I did. We had a supply drop at Bor, and the Japanese then had closed in on the Irrawaddy and the Swale. So we were in a ring of enemy, formed by the enemy, not in great strength, but in patrols which could bring on great strength in next to no time. We then, from there on, I got the rope dropped, signal to the Air Force, to drop me a floating rope, which they did the next night. By then, the Japanese hadn't realised where I was with my column, bearing in mind the other British column to the south was still holding together. That was under Ken Jukes. And that was Bernard Fergus was 5 column, Jilks was 7, and I was 8. Now, Ken Jilks made up his mind that once he got across the Swale, he was heading for China, which he did. He crossed the Swale and headed for China and came out a month later. I got the rope across the Swale. It had to be knotted. And what I did there, we had RAF rescue balloons, balloon type of rafts. They're blown up, and it would take about 8 men. And we put a loop on the rope, and the chaps were pulling themselves across, lifting the loop we'd put on the rope over the knot and carrying on. I'd got about 40 men across when one of the sergeants panicked a bit. He was taking his 8 men across with him, and the rope, his loop would not get over the knot. The knots, the swale was then flowing at a rate of knots. And he pulled out his dar to cut the loop. Instead, he cut the main rope. He went sailing down with the rest of these 8 men with him. The ropes parted. I was left on the area between the Irrawaddy and the Swale. My second in command and 40 men were the other side, on the China side of the Swale. The men in the raft who'd cut adrift went down the Swale and down near Wadi for a number of miles. They were all captured, actually. The sergeant himself died just before we released Rangoon, before we captured Rangoon. His men all survived in prison war camp. The Royal Air Force dropped me another rope the next night, and we got across by going again over the loop and going hand over hand, and they also dropped me several rubber boats which we used. I got the balance of the Colmar Cross. By then my second in command and his 40 men, I'd given authority to make their own way back to India, which he did for a while, and then they were ambushed and he was killed and most of the chaps with him were captured. 4 chaps came across and I picked them up later on. Our own progress, I had my CO with me, Colonel Cook, who was very, very sick, like a lot of the men, and I headed for an area of the Irrawaddy we hadn't used before, that is just above the gorge, below Barmo, where the Irrawaddy races through.
Below where? Below where?
Barmo, B-H-M-O. Barmo, some 20 miles below Barmo, and I was waiting to make rafts. Well, we made some rafts, but with the rate of current, it was just hopeless. They went down as soon as we'd put them in the water, practically. The villages where I was, I had no village boats. They said the Japanese, who were about 5 miles to north of me, had taken in all the boats. So I then had to debate whether I should tackle the Japanese garrison, get the boats, and get across that way. But I realised if we carried that plan out, the Japanese would have brought many greater strength down on us, and before we could have got across, we would have been annihilated with them all actually on the Irrawaddy itself. As it happened, coming up through the gorge the next morning, I noted that the large Burmese junks had to pole their way up the Irrawaddy. They were heading for Barmo, and after a while, one came quite close to our side, the middle of the day, and I and several others jumped in and captured it. And that by that night, the whole of my balance of my column had got across the Irrawaddy. We only had one mule, but by the time it got the other side, it was our wireless mule I'd kept. It was a very sick animal. I got the rest and my CO across, who was then a very sick man. We then moved across the Irrawaddy as fast as we could, because I cleaned the junks out and gave the two boatmen more money than make for the rest of the year, practically. And so they wouldn't tell the Japanese because, you know, they'd have been killed if they had done. They went off on the way to Bamo, and I went off into the thick jungle. I still had the wireless, but the mule obviously wasn't going to last longer. On the third day, the mule died. Well, it was dying, and we had to kill it. I then sent on the signal that where we would be in 4 days' time, 4 or 5 days' time, and I'd like the Royal Air Force to drop me 14 days' rations. And a week later, I would be in the area of such and such a map reference, just beyond the railway, and I planned that we'd have these drops all the way out of Burma. When we were just a few nights later, we were coming to the first dropping zone I'd given the Royal Air Force, and I walked out into a clearing. And to me, it was about 1,500 yards wide, long, and about 400 yards wide. My thoughts right away were, a rescue. If they come to supplies, I wonder could they land and fly my wounded out. By that time, I had 12 men and my CEO who certainly wouldn't have made the Chinwin. I knew that. They came across the Air Force the following day as arranged, dropped our rations, and as soon as they dropped the first lot of rations, by then my wireless had gone dead, the batteries had gone, so I couldn't signal them again, hoping, of course, that they'd follow on the rest of the drops I'd arranged. They came for this first drop, and as they dropped the first parachutes, I used the parachutes and wrote a signal on the floor of the jungle, "Plane land here now." Wounded. And that aircraft circled twice and then tried to get down. He just couldn't make it. And he flew off, but before he went, he dropped me a tape along steamer saying, "Hold on here." And 2 days later, I got no supply drop in case they couldn't make it. So I then had 12 days' rations with me, so I could go quite a long way without any more assistance from the Royal Air Force. But 2 days later, a plane came across, dropped a streamer, and asked me to mark out what I considered was the fair run for a plane to land. Again, I used the parachutes and made blobs, white parachute blobs, right across the area. I gave him something like 1,000 yards with blobs of white parachute every 50 or 60 yards. He came down, tried one run and lifted again. The second run, he landed. And he flew my CO and my 14 sick men. Within 2 hours, they were in hospital in Imphal. I got a signal from them to say, and another wireless set, the signal say that hold on there, they might try and rescue more of us. However, it was decided that Dakotas are very few and far between at that stage, and they felt, and I rightly agreed, that the garrison at Indore, which wasn't very far away, had been told of our plane landing, and the sooner I got away from the area, the better, which is what I did. And then I set off to walk out the rest of the time to India. I came across the railway, didn't meet any of the enemy. I had a bit of a fracas with them in the hills beyond, but nothing great, and I was then fairly strong.
What was the character of that battle?
Oh, can I go back a bit?
Yes.
Before I got clear of the dropping area where they'd flown my wounded out, I came to the Korkwe Chom, and what the Japanese had done, they hadn't attacked us where we were when the plane down, but they'd put a force in blobs all along the Korkwe Chom, which was about 30 yards wide in parts, and in other parts only 16 or 17 yards. And at the time, we'd made bamboo rafts, and I'd been pulling the men across. And I'd got practically everybody, bar about two loads of men, about 10 men when the Japanese attacked us and we were dispersed. I blew the dispersal signal rather than be pinned against the Chong, and we evaded the Japanese. I lost four men there, four men killed, and they must have kept in something like 12 captured. I then gave the dispersal again for them to keep going round in small parties, and we linked up at a rendezvous which I'd already arranged between the Khoekhoi Chong and the railway. We formed up again, we crossed the railway, and then we had a trouble-free area right through to the Chinwin. I took the dentist forest, the dentist area I could, to avoid any contact with the Japanese, and we didn't see any more Japanese. I got into a village on the Chinwin River, and with their assistance I crossed in the middle of the night, where by next morning we'd all crossed, and then we made then our way to Imphal. That was the first phase.
When you had that battle with the Japanese on the Khoekhoi Chong, how close to the Japanese did you come?
Oh, they were in amongst us. The Japanese got in amongst us, but what they were doing, they were throwing grenades at us rather than come in with a bayonet at all. And they crippled one of my best colour sergeants, well, my colour sergeant, who was an outstanding soldier. He'd shot his left knee right through. The bullet had hit him and shattered his kneecap on the left and his left leg. I went to lift him on, and he said, "No, sir." He said, "You'll never make it. You've got your duty is to get the rest of these men out, and I must stay here and see what happens." And I again lifted him, but he was hurt. He was hurting him too much. He said, "Please, please leave me." And one of the saddest times of my life, I had to leave him. And he was there on the bank. We left him food, but he never heard of again. So it would appear that the Japanese just came in and he'd either died or they'd killed him, because he did not turn up in the prisoner of war camp like four other people did from that prisoner of war camp. I was in Rangoon. So I lost a very good colour sergeant. I won't mention his name because I've been in